The teacher in this book is determined to drive us to God. And I'm afraid he does it by causing us some pain. He basically, through this book, he takes all the stuff that we live for, all the stuff that we seek in life, and he basically says, wake up. Wake up to the reality that your life is like but a breath. The merest of breaths. Wake up. Imagine a cup of cold water thrown in your face early in the morning, and you're kind of, oh, hey, what? What was that for? Imagine you were having a great dream and you thought it was real. In your dream, you were like God and you loved it. Everything you wanted, you were able to get, and it was brilliant. Everything you touched turned to gold, you know. Every problem you were able to fix. Everything you made was perfect and lasting forever. Everything made sense. Everything was fulfilling. Everything was becoming right and just and fair. Whatever the issue, you could deal with it. You know, chaos, sickness, decay. Nothing was too difficult. You were basically able to exert control over everything. The master of your own fate. The captain of your own ship. And in this dream, you didn't want it to end. And then suddenly, splash, you're rudely awoken with a very unpleasant cup of water in your face, and it's time to enter the real world. That is kind of the book of Ecclesiastes. That's really what it's about. It's a dose of reality to kind of wake us up, and it's reality that we don't really want to think about, and yet we have to. The teacher in this chapter is determined that we take an honest look at all the oppression in the world, verses 1 to 3, an honest look at all our work and striving to achieve in verses 4 to 8, an honest look at our relationships in verses 9 to 12, and finally an honest look at the limitations of wisdom in verses 13 to 16. But like I said this morning, we've only got time to look at verses 1 to 3. And there is some pain here, but it's worth it. So look at verse 1, Ecclesiastes 4. Again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Part and parcel of being oppressed and powerless is that there seems no way out. There's no one to comfort. A friend of mine worked for a number of years with street kids in Brazil, and they were as young as 10 years old, the ones that she was working with. Most come from broken families, their parents often having an unstable or a violent relationship. The kids have little or no contact with their families. The other children of the street become their family. They live and eat and sleep on the street. She said that it's normal for them to sniff glue or other drugs like paint thinner. Out on the streets, they don't have anyone around them to correct them or give them love and support, safety or structure. Lots of them are, of course, undernourished. Lots have AIDS or other sexually transmitted diseases. Sometimes they earn money by selling their own bodies, boys and girls. Often they are offered small jobs in drug dealing where they can earn some fast money. And there's a big chance that boys like this connect with criminal gangs and groups. That was the kind of thing that my friend wrote about whenever she sent her email updates. And it's just a drop in the ocean, isn't it? It's a drop in the ocean. Who can measure all the oppression, injustice, and exploitation in the world? The word oppression occurs three times, just in verse 1, reminding us that we live in a dog-eat-dog world. And the teacher in this book can hardly bear it. Because from where he is standing, it would seem that the dead, who had already died, are surely happier than the living who are still alive, verse 2. I mean, at least their suffering is over. Now, at this point in salvation history, the teacher doesn't yet see the fullness of Christian hope. He knows God will put everything right in the end, and he does have faith in God. But right now, he just stares at the brutality of life. And he compares it with those who are no longer suffering. He's not advocating euthanasia, by the way. You won't find that anywhere in the Bible. It is only for God to give and to take away. But he wants to wake us up to the reality that life is so full of pain for so many people. Indeed, the teacher even says in verse 3, it's a shocking verse, but he says in verse 3 that better than both the living who suffer oppression and the dead who are now free from that oppression, better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. Now, we're tempted to think that this is too dark a perspective for a man of faith, but you know, he's simply pointing out a fact that the unborn have never seen or experienced the evil that is in our world. And such is the teacher's hatred of the evil in our world, he's able to say what he says in verse 3. You know, you think of a baby in its mother's womb, totally safe, totally at peace, no crying, no tears, and yet, you know, as soon as the baby is born, all that changes. I actually remember holding my own, obviously my kids are fine, but I remember holding my own children in my arms seconds after they were born, and thinking, gosh, you were happier 5 minutes ago. Welcome to the world. Now, of course, he's not saying that life is not beautiful or enjoyable. Again and again in this book, he urges us to enjoy life as and when we can. But he calls us to do that in the context of knowing that we need God. You see, a lot of people think they have no need for God. Some people even hold out the ridiculous notion that the human race is becoming more civilized all the time. It's not. And maybe if we looked at the brutality of the world just a bit longer than we normally do, then we'd learn to long, and cry out for the justice that only God can bring. Perhaps we don't think a whole lot about the kingdom that is coming because we shield ourselves as best we can from the brutality of the world. You know, we close our eyes, we flick the channel, we shut it out. And it's understandable, of course, I do that. We shut it out. But the teacher here is trying to wake us up. He's trying to wake us up to the reality that we need God and his kingdom, because this world is so screwed up. We need the justice that he alone can bring. We need the God whose almighty power can be trusted. The God who brings justice out of tyranny, order out of chaos, life out of death. We need this God. And if we have never got on our knees and cried for that, well then, we've never stared long enough at the brutality that is in our world. We're called to work for justice. And we thank God for International Justice Mission and groups like that. We're called to work for justice, knowing that God will not let such brutality and oppression go on forever. So, like, who are we trying to kid when we live and act as if God is irrelevant in the world? People often say, though, don't they? They often say, how can you believe in God in a world of so much injustice and pain? But really, we need to turn the question right around, because the teacher in this book is turning the question right around. Not that he has any glib answers to the problem of evil and suffering, but the teacher has a better question. We have a better question. The real question is, how can you live without God in a world of so much injustice and pain? Think about that. How can you live without God in a world of so much injustice and pain? I mean, doing away with God, as so many people want to do, clearly does not do away with the problem. Rejecting belief in God does not solve anything. It only gives you a much, much bigger problem. Because you've still got injustice, and you've still got pain, only now you've got no hope whatsoever, and no reason to even call it injustice. I mean, it's just life, you know? lions eat zebras, the strong eat the weak, the powerful people trample on poor people. So what? If there's no God, it's not wrong in any absolute sense. It's just life, survival of the fittest. If there's no God, then Richard Dawkins was right when he said that at bottom there is no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA, he says, neither knows nor cares. DNA just is. So why be troubled by so-called evil and suffering? You see, you take God out of the picture, and our sense of justice and injustice actually doesn't even make sense whatsoever. And yet we cry out for justice. Why? Because there is a God who made us in his own image. And therefore we instinctively know that there is such a thing as right and wrong. There is such a thing as human rights. Rights that are inherently ours by nature of being human. Whether there is any legislation to protect us or not. Human life does have unique value and worth above all other creatures, and we know that. We are not mere ants scuttling around the earth. We have rights. And yet, here's what I'm trying to say. The reality of human rights, which is undeniable, and the reality of our sense of good and evil, which is undeniable, only makes sense if there is a God who made us in his own image, and who calls us to love what is right and to hate what is evil. The teacher in this book is determined to drive us to God. Because relative good is not good enough. You know, he says, it's good to be alive, you might say, and yet the oppressed have no comforter. Oh, well, it's happier for the dead, you might say, and yet death in this book appears to render everything meaningless. Oh, well, it's better to be unborn then, you might say, and yet that's hardly the answer to the world's problems, is it? Relative good is not good enough. And this whole chapter actually spells that out and as it looks at different subjects. Relative good is not good enough. What we need is a redeemer. We need a redeemer. We need God and God's eternal life. And thankfully, that is exactly what the Bible, of course, reveals to us. It reveals to us the gift of God's only Son, Jesus, who entered this world full of oppression in order to freely qualify us for his kingdom, his heavenly kingdom. Remember what it says in Isaiah 53? He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. By oppression and judgment, he was taken away, cut off from the land of the living. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. People say, where is God? Our God knows all about oppression. He knows all about oppression. This table reminds us this morning that he knows all about oppression and injustice. He took it up, and he bore it. And he wasn't a helpless victim. Instead, he was actually on a mission to rescue us from sin and death and hell. What he went through is what we deserved. But he did it so that we could receive the very opposite of what we deserve. He was pierced for our transgressions, Isaiah put it. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That's what this table proclaims this morning. And if you know him, if we know the Lord Jesus and know all that he achieved for us at the cross, then we can actually take up the words of verse 2 here in chapter 4 and apply them to the profound hope that we have in Jesus. Think of Paul in Philippians chapter 1. Remember, Paul is in prison. He's oppressed. He's facing a very possible execution at the hands of Rome. And what does Paul say? He says, For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. that is his perspective in a world full of oppression. To live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to go on living in the body, he says, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I don't know. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far, says Paul the Apostle. And he goes on. Can you echo his words this morning? Do you know that solid joy amid all the reality of our tears and sadness? This table that we're going to gather around in just a moment is so that we will know it more deeply. It's so that we will know that despite all our sin, God has freely qualified us for his eternal kingdom, his heavenly kingdom. And it's so that we will long more fervently for Christ to return and bring his kingdom in. And so that we will live for him alone as we wait for that great day. May God realign our perspectives in line with his holy word as the teacher calls for. To him be the glory.